Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the release today of the so-called perversion files that the Oregon Supreme Court forced the Boy Scouts of America to make public. Peter Zuckerman, who broke the story of child sex abuse in the Boy Scouts for the Idaho Falls Post-Register, joins us. Peter was hounded by Idaho's richest man, who tried to stop publication of the expose by outing the reporter and his partner. That man, Frank Vandersloot, is now one of Mitt Romney's biggest donors and the National Finance Committee co-chair of the Romney for President campaign. Then we'll examine the China bashing that went on in the last presidential debate with Clive Prestowitz, who is the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. We'll discuss why China's middle class is growing and ours is shrinking, and Clyde Prestowitz's article at CNN, Can iPhones and iPads Be Made in the USA? Then finally, we'll discuss the likely outbreak of a war between the world's newest country, South Sudan, and its northern neighbor, Sudan, that is run by a serial killer, General Omar al-Bashir, the only world leader indicted by the International Criminal Court. David Phillips, the director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights and author of the new e-book, Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy and U.S. Intervention, joins us. And joining us now is Peter Zuckerman, who is a nonfiction writer and journalist. He's reported for the Oregonian and the Idaho Falls Post-Register on child sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts of America. In 2005, Zuckerman won the Livingston Award for a six-part series published in the Post-Register titled Scouts Honor, as well as the Scripps Howard Foundation's National Journalism Award. He's been profiled in a PBS documentary in a small town and has come under attack for his reporting on the Boy Scouts and the Mormon Church. His new book, which won the George Orwell Award, is Buried in the Sky, which tells the true story of the 2008 K2 mountaineering disaster. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Zuckerman.
Thanks for having me.
And today, the Boy Scouts of America released their so-called perversion files under an order of the Oregon Supreme Court. More than 1,200 files have been released. And you've been involved in exposing child abuse within the Boy Scouts of America for some time now. Where does it stand now? I mean, it's been so long to get this file released. The file goes from the 1960s through to 1985. What impact is it likely to have?
I think the impact could be huge. When you look at the volume of abuse, the Boy Scouts confidential files, also known as the perversion files or the red files, they are thought by experts to be the largest documentation of child abuse ever documented anywhere. So just in sheer quantity of documents about abuse, this is a huge compendium. And there are, you know, just thousands and thousands of children who have been affected by this. And, you know, they could step forward and it's possible it could be like the Catholic Church.
Well, what seems to be consistent with this Boy Scout scandal and the Catholic Church scandal is that an attempt was made in the Catholic Church by apologists for the enormous payoffs and pedophile activity that's been going on was to conflate homosexuality with child abuse. And it seems like the Boy Scouts of America have done the same thing. They still continue to ban gays in the Boy Scouts, yet the national chairman of the Youth Protection Task Force of the Boy Scouts of America was convicted in 2005 of distributing child porn.
Yeah, you know, it really is. I mean, I'm gay, and it really is hard to understand why the Boy Scouts would continue to ban gays, supposedly to endanger children, and would simultaneously be protecting child molesters by fighting so hard, for instance, to not release this information, to refuse to release this information. And these policies that they've had, they've reaffirmed their ban on gays, they've reaffirmed their secrecy measures about child molesting. And, you know, when they do this, I mean, they're not just hurting adults, they're really hurting gay kids who, you know, suffer so much suicide and so much bullying. And they really ought to spend their efforts on protecting the kids against the real danger, which is child molesting, and just you know, start treating everybody else equally and doing what's best for all their members.
So, Peter Zuckerman, again, a journalist who reported for the Oregonian and the Idaho Falls Post, register on child sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts of America and won a number of awards for it. The Oregon Supreme Court forced the release of these 1,200 files, the so-called perversion files that the Boy Scouts of America had under wraps for some time. This came out of an Oregon lawsuit in 2010, which resulted in the largest judgment against the Boy Scouts, the jury awarding nearly $20 million to a man who was molested by an assistant scoutmaster in the early 1980s, ruling basically established that the Boy Scouts had failed to protect the plaintiff here. Now, I understand that when this lawsuit happened, the Mormon Church was also sued, and they quickly settled. So what's the connection between the Mormon Church and the Boy Scouts of America?
The Boy Scouts and the Mormon Church are very, very closely tied. The Boy Scouts has been the official men's program of the Mormon Church since the early 1900s, and on a national and local level, you know, maybe a quarter to a third of the prominent Boy Scout leaders are Mormons, and just when you look at the number of Boy Scout members, the number of kids involved in troops, there's also about a third of them are Mormons by the last numbers I was able to find. And the Mormon Church, you know, may or may not have a problem with abuse. Whenever abuse cases arise, they seem to get settled very quickly for undisclosed amounts. And these files could definitely give us a window into what kind of abuse may be going on within the Mormon Church. They've been also, like the Boy Scouts, very, very secretive about it. And that's part of the problem. It's you know, secrecy is what allows molesters to get away with things. And in my opinion, really the key is to be as transparent as possible and just to come out with everything that's happened and be upfront with people about the risks. And I worry about the Mormon Church and other very conservative organizations that are very, very closed and reluctant to discuss these things, because the key to dealing with them is putting it out in the open, just as is happening now.
Well, Peter Zuckerman, what do we know about the 1,247 men who were expelled from the Boy Scouts because of charges of child molestation? The files that were released today will name these men. Of course, the victims' names have been redacted in the files. How would we know what percentage of these men were members of the Mormon Church?
It will be hard to tell. It may be possible to tell based on the troops that they're associated with, but it will be difficult to tell what percentage are related to the Mormon Church or to, you know, other churches, because the way the files are laid out, they do not typically tell you the religious affiliation of the scout troop. But it is probably nowadays, in the age of Google, you can, you know, possibly look up the scout troop and figure out the religious affiliation of the troop. Most scout troops have a religious affiliation, and many of them are Mormon. But it's not going to be a clear-cut answer. It'll require significantly more research before we know exactly how this relates to, you know, alleged abuse within the Mormon Church.
Well, but the reason that you're bringing it up is, I take it, is to do with the influence that the Mormon Church has over the Boy Scouts. They are the dominant group, are they not, in terms of...
They are by far the dominant group within the Boy Scouts. And yeah, they work with the Boy Scouts very, very closely. And so if you have a problem with one within one organization with the Boy Scouts, it's very likely a big overlap within the Mormon Church. But also within other groups, there's also likely overlap with other organizations as well.
So specifically, what attacks have come your way from the Boy Scouts of America and the Mormon Church for reporting?
In the reporting, when I was working in Idaho, the richest man in Idaho, a very prominent Mormon, went after me based on my sexual orientation, took out attack ads trying to discredit the stories I'd written, and really just blocked out a lot of the reporting by making people afraid of me, afraid to talk to me because I'm gay. I think ultimately we got a lot of those stories, but they were willing to go after me personally about a problem that, you know, is a societal problem that we should just be dealing with. And I thought that was really, it was an awful thing to have to go through, and that it was bad for the kids, that, you know, if we want to help protect kids from child molesters, we need to get the stories out there, and we need to encourage people to come forward, not attack the people who are delivering the message.
So Peter Zuckerman, again, journalist who reported for the Oregonian and the Idaho Falls Post-Register on child sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts of America organization. And in 2005, Peter Zuckerman won the Livingston Award for a six-part series published in the Post-Register titled Scouts Honor. So that's the series that they tried to shut down, this rich Mormon, by taking out ads against you and saying that you were gay and trying to stop people from talking to you. Obviously, if you got an award for this series, it must have been published and it must have been seen.
Yeah, the story really took off. People attacked it, but it was based on, you know, court records and interviews with people who, you know, who stood up and said, yes, he got the facts right. So the facts of the story, there was no request for corrections. It was an accurate, fairly told story. And the result of the story, ultimately, the Idaho Supreme Court changed its court procedures so that it would be harder to hide court cases. The state changed its child protection laws so it was easier to go after child molesters. And ultimately, you know, the series was very, very well received. But at first, which was, you know, and especially while I was really working on it, they made it incredibly difficult. And, you know, people were blocking me out, and it was a really terrible situation to be through, and it was a terrible situation for my partner, who actually lost his job over the whole thing. And then I think it's interesting to note that the man who was behind the charge against me, Frank Vandersloot, he is now Mitt Romney's lead finance chair. He's a lead fundraiser for the Romney campaign. And so it's made me wonder a lot about, you know, the influence of the church and of the judgment of the people who are, you know, potentially behind somebody who could become the president.
And the extent to which the president, or the presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, is posing now as a moderate, after having run as a conservative. So that the fact that his finance chairman went on a jihad against you and resorted to these gutter tactics of outing you as being gay when it had nothing to do with your reporting, would, I think that certainly gives us pause. That I'm quite shocked to hear that.
Yeah, I was quite shocked to see that he had become the finance co-chairman. And I think that it makes you wonder, you know, when you raise a lot of money for a presidential candidate, you presumably are going to get something in exchange, that you are, in a sense, the string puller in chief. And so I think it's fair to look at who is giving that money and who those people are. And I'd like to say that I was not the only person who has ever been attacked by this guy. He's gone after, you know, among other things, you know, PBS for, you know, airing a documentary that he didn't like that talked about, ironically, bullies in schools, bullies who bully people for being gay. And so, I mean, I was not alone here, and there's a really terrible history.
So again, Peter Zuckerman, journalist who reported for the Oregonian and the Idaho Falls Post-Register on child sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts of America, and won the 2005 Livingston Award for his six-part series published in the Post-Register titled Scout's Honor. He's also the author of the new book, which just won the George Orwell Award, Buried in the Sky, which tells the true story of the 2008 K2 mountaineering disaster. Peter, in these files that have been released today, because of a court order from the Oregon Supreme Court that have been buried for some time, apparently the files show a clear pattern of what's called grooming behavior that alleged molesters used to seduce these young boys under their care. And clearly, you know, they're out on camping trips in the wilderness, etc. They have, these kids are both accessible and vulnerable.
Yeah, you know, Boy Scouts is just by design, I mean, just unfortunately, it is a child molester magnet. I mean, if you want to abuse kids, you want to find vulnerable kids who are alone and gain their trust. The Boy Scouts is the place that a lot of child molesters go. And a camping environment provides a lot of opportunities for molesters to groom potential victims, from, you know, helping the kids win badges to, you know, giving them massages to, you know, being alone with them in the tents. You know, ideally, the Boy Scouts' policies are actually that an adult should never be alone with the kid. I think in practice, that's a very, it's just not always done. And if that policy was followed, if it was always followed, I think it would really cut down on the abuse. And I do think it's worth noting that the worst cases are from the 1960s and 70s, and to some extent the 80s. The later cases, there's less information about, but it does seem that at least in the 80s there was some improvement. Although there were not any major changes made most recently after Douglas Sovereign Smith, the chairman of the Youth Protection Task Force, was arrested for and convicted of trading child porn. And that kind of surprised me, because I thought that if, you know, the person in charge of child protection is actually a pedophile himself, that might really make you want to reassess exactly what you're doing and change the procedures you have.
So just in closing Peter Zuckerman, my understanding is that there's some of the people on the board of the Boy Scouts of America, some of the corporate leaders that are on that board, some of them want to overturn this ban. I guess this guy Vandersloot, who you mentioned, who went after you and who's now the co-chair of Mitt Romney's finance committee, he must still have some sway. But what? But isn't the chairman of AT&T, one of these big companies, trying to at least join the 21st century here?
Yeah, there is division within within the Boy Scouts over whether they should start, you know, treating everybody fairly and allow gays to join the Boy Scouts. And I think the main thought is you know, doing so would be what's best for the kids. I mean, there are gay children. They need role models. They shouldn't be, you know, openly discriminated against. You know, suicide and bullying and is a huge problem among gay kids. And I think if the Boy Scouts wants to do what's best for the kids, they should be allowing gays, they should allow gay scouts to serve openly, and they should provide those scouts with role models instead of telling them there's something wrong with them and kicking them out.
Well, Peter Zuckerman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Peter Zuckerman, who is a journalist who has reported for the Oregonian and the Idaho Falls Post Register on child sexual abuse within the Boy Scouts of America organization. In 2005, he won the Livingston Award for a six-part series published in the Post Register titled Scouts Honor, as well as the Scripps Howard Foundation's National Journalism Award. He's been profiled in a PBS documentary in a small town and has come under attack for his reporting on the Boy Scouts and the Mormon Church. His new book, which won the George Orwell Award, is Buried in the Sky, which tells the true story of the 2008 K2 mountaineering disaster. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about China, the new political whipping boy, and whether iPads can be made here in the United States.
Be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Clyde Prestowitz, the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nations, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East, and his latest is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He has an article at CNN, Can iPhone and iPad Be Made in the USA? Welcome to Background Briefing, Clyde Prestowitz.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And clearly you're responding to the second presidential debate where the trade with China the cheater, came up on a number of occasions, and moderator Candy Crowley noted that Apple makes its iPhones and iPads in China, asking the candidates, how do you convince a great American company to bring that manufacturing back here? What would you have answered, Clyde Prestowitz?
Well, I would have said that actually the phones aren't made in China. They're assembled in China, but actually the bulk of the key parts, the semiconductors, the electronic display, the digital signal processors, the guts of the phone that makes it really high-tech and makes it really smart, come from Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and Germany. None of those are low-wage countries. None of them are low environmental regulation countries. They just happen to be very competitive. And those products are not labor intensive. They're capital and technology intensive. We in the U.S. are supposed to be good in high tech and good in capital intensive products. And so I think there's no reason why that production can't be done in the U.S., but to do it means that you've got to have the worker skills, you've got to have the tax environment that's correct, and you've got to have government support for creating trade agreements that really work.
So the assembly of these products by Foxconn, the big Taiwanese company, you're saying that's just a minor part of it.
Let's take an iPhone. At wholesale, an iPhone is maybe $180 of cost, of which about $6.50 is the assembly in China.
But presumably, Apple does it for a reason in China. They must be.
Well, I think the assembly being done in China is for a reason. $6.50 assembly is very inexpensive. That kind of assembly cannot be done at that cost in the U.S. What I'm saying is, I don't want the assembly to come back from China. I don't think we can do that competitively. What I want is the digital signal processors, the microprocessors, the electronic display screen, the high value added components that are now being done in Japan and Korea. I want them done in the U.S.
So, Clyde Prestowitz, I find it extraordinary that, you know, you can make the same argument about broadband in this country. You know, we have broadband diffusion and access is going down and down and down, even though the fiber optics are there right across the country. And after all, we invented the internet and fiber optics and broadband, but yet we're slipping behind the rest of the world. And we also invented the semiconductor. So why is it that we can't no longer manufacture American inventions?
Well, I think there are two major factors. And one is that we have not maintained the kind of competitive and production environment in the U.S. that we had 20 or 30 years ago. And that comes down to a matter of we haven't responded to trade policies that countries like Korea and China and others have pursued. We've adopted the view that it doesn't matter what we make, that we'll let them make the chips and we'll make potato chips or chocolate chips or something like that. And the second major factor is that the environment in the U.S., the tax environment for corporations is such that China or Singapore offers a company a couple of billion dollars if they'll put their factory in that country. We don't respond. And so over time, the production has leached out of the U.S. Then the third factor is the value of the dollar. Many countries intervene in exchange markets to buy dollars to hold the value of the dollar high, which means that the price of U.S. exports is high, and the cost of importing products priced in dollars in foreign countries is high. We haven't responded to this manipulation of the dollar. And so all of the incentives in the global economy are such as to move the production of tradable goods out of the U.S.
Again, I'm speaking with Clyde Prestovich, the former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. His latest book is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Market Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He has an article at CNN, Can iPhone and iPad Be Made in the USA? Now, of course, in the second presidential debate, China came up a lot. Mitt Romney actually said that on day one he'd call China a cheater. I'm not sure what the consequences of that might be. But isn't there another side to the story here? It's not the complete story that the Chinese manipulate the currency. They also buy U.S. Treasury bills, don't they? Aren't they financing our debt to some extent?
They certainly are. They hold about $1.2 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries. And that's part of this currency manipulation issue that I mentioned and that Mitt Romney talks about. That. And Romney frequently in his speeches talks about he's going to, on day one, label China a currency manipulator. That sounds tough. And it's certainly correct that China has been manipulating its currency. But the truth is that once Romney says that, you know, then what is the action that's going to follow? And the only action that follows on to labeling them a currency manipulator is that the International Monetary Fund then will call for formal consultations between the U.S. and China. So unless Romney's prepared to do something besides formal consultations, which in fact the Obama administration has already been doing informal consultations, it's not clear that, you know, there's any real serious bite there.
So I'm just curious to know why all of a sudden China's being vilified and becoming a political football. I understand that their growth rate is incredibly important to the leadership there. And the leadership, of course, has been very apparently under a lot of strain from internal scandals. They've delayed having their big Politburo handoff to the new generation of leadership. So they obviously have a very opaque political system, and it's always been an enormous paradox that they are allegedly a communist country when they're some of the planet's most aggressive capitalists. My understanding is, for example, China is doing what it can to stop the euro from crashing. Last time we spoke was about where you were talking about, you know, what the hell's wrong with these European governments? You know, why are they dawdling for so long? My understanding is that China is doing what they can as a responsible partner. They don't want these markets to dry up. They don't want our economy to crash as well, don't they?
Well, certainly China does not want either the U.S. or the EU markets to crash, that's for sure. I think that they buy U.S. treasuries, as you pointed out. They also buy euro bonds. But I don't know that that's solely a matter of trying to help Europe and the U.S. It also is a matter of, as you point out, trying to make China earns these surpluses. They got to be invested someplace. And so they come back to these places. I think, you know, when you talk about China being vilified, I think we have to kind of parse that. We have a huge trade deficit with China. In the last decade, something like 5 million U.S. jobs have been offshored to China. And that obviously gives rise to concerns about what's the nature of our trade. Why is it that we have this huge deficit? Why are we losing jobs to this place? And, you know, I think the explanation is a mixed explanation. Part of it is that the Chinese have been very effective in their economic development strategies, in absorbing technology, in becoming competitive, in working assiduously to penetrate U.S. and other foreign markets, and nothing wrong with that. But part of it is that China has pursued policies that have forced technology transfer, that have infringed on intellectual property, patents, and trademarks, and so forth, that have distorted international currency markets, kept the value of the dollar higher than it should have been. And so these are all practices and policies that are at odds with the rules of the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund, of which China is a member. And so, you know, complaining or urging the Chinese to stop doing those things, if they are doing them, is not vilifying them. It's just kind of telling it like it is.
Well, indeed, I think there's ample evidence that China has had a very aggressive economic espionage program here in the United States, along with a military traditional espionage program. My understanding is that the Chinese were able to put some very sophisticated sleeper bug in a lot of government computers, and they also went after the patent office, where the sleeper bug was able to take all of the latest patents and send them to China, and also the designs for our latest nuclear warheads, etc. So there's no question that they've been active in
busy boys.
Yeah. So, but the question is I mean, I'm not trying to get them off the hook, but who is this that's doing this? Is this the Chinese government or the military, or do they speak with one voice? Are they all coordinating?
Well, I think it's all of the above. I think an important thing to understand is that China, and not just China, but countries like Korea, like Japan, like Singapore, even Germany, these countries have an economic strategy in which government leaders, business leaders, labor leaders, academic leaders, technology leaders talk to each other. And they think about how to keep the country or make the country competitive. They think about how to coordinate their activities, how to develop policies, programs, practices with regard to the U.S., with regard to other major countries that will maximize the productive potential of their country. And their income and their standard of living. We take the so-called Anglo-Saxon approach, which is to just kind of let everything rip. We don't have an industrial policy. We don't have an economic strategy. We have convinced ourselves that just letting everybody pursue their own interest without coordination, without policy, is the optimum way to operate. But it turns out that we seem to keep losing out in this competition, and so maybe we need to rethink that.
Well, there's no doubt, I think, that the Chinese Communist Party is something of a mafia, and it's true that they have made some kind of devil's bargain with their own people, that we will raise your standard of living, but you better stay in line, otherwise we'll crack your heads. And, you know, I did a piece recently on the artist Ai Weiwei, who's being persecuted, and a very brave person he is. So obviously there's a line in China you can't cross. But I suppose, though, in a way, to trying to be fair here, the idea that China is creating the world's biggest middle class that may well exceed the entire population of the United States, and India is doing something along those lines, and a lot of the political debate that's going on here in the United States in this presidential election is the fate of the middle class, you know, where you've got President Obama saying he's going to rescue the middle class and more or less implying that Romney, being a representative of the 1%, doesn't care about the middle class. And, of course, Romney's come back and said, no, I really do care about the middle class. So both sides are telling us how much they care about rescuing and building America's middle class. Meanwhile, China is actually doing it.
China certainly has been very successful in creating a middle class, and as you say, maybe bigger than the entire population of the U.S. and other Western countries. We have seen real stagnation and decline in the U.S. middle class. Median household income has not budged over the past 40 years. And we've seen actually decline in wages of working people on the median basis in the U.S. So this is a, you know, this appeal to the middle class that both Romney and Obama are trying to make has a reason, and has a reason because the middle class is suffering.
But the reality is that there has to be a structural reason why our middle class is suffering and China's middle class is being created and booming.
Well, I think it comes back to a couple of the points you made earlier. China has been focusing intensely on high-speed economic growth, export-led economic growth, infusion of technology, education into its economy. And, of course, China's in a catch-up mode, so it's not having to reinvent things or invent things. It's able to absorb technology and techniques and practices that have already been proven in other places like Japan and Korea and Singapore and the U.S. And so it has done that very effectively. I think the problem in the U.S. is that we have not been effective in maintaining a competitive, productive base. We have tended to overconsume, underinvest. We haven't kept up in the education sweepstakes. We have not pursued trade policies that have kept the playing field level for U.S.-based production. The incentives in the global economy, the dollar is overvalued. U.S. Corporate taxes are higher than in virtually all other countries. The investment incentives are stronger in most of the other major countries in the world. So all of the incentives in the global economy are to move the production of tradable goods and the provision of tradable services out of the U.S. And that's what's been happening. And as that has happened, wages have stagnated and middle-class living standards have stagnated or declined.
So just in closing then, Clyde Presowitz, I'm curious to know what the mechanics of this situation are. I understand that the great advantage that the U.S. has and still has is in its intellectual property, that we still have the best and brightest in terms of inventions and inventors and innovators. And also that we also bring in a lot of brainy people from abroad on the H-2 visas. And we also, our universities are open to an awful lot of students from overseas, including a lot of students from China. I believe that in engineering, for example, in the University of California, something like 80% of the students are Chinese. So we, you know, in spite of what they keep saying about education, and it's true that across the board, education has gone to the dogs in America, but still in terms of higher education, there's still some fairly stellar operations that you can point to. So why are we inventing so much and our entire economic future depends upon intellectual property, yet we're not protecting our intellectual property?
Let's use a concrete example, okay? First of all, let's talk about education. The United States, I think, unquestionably has the world's leading, the greatest concentration of the world's leading higher educational institutions, MIT, Caltech, Harvard, Stanford. We have more of those than anybody else. But you made the point. If you go into the PhD programs, in engineering and in sciences at MIT, Caltech, Stanford, Harvard, over 50% of the students are not Americans. They're Chinese, they're Indians, they're from other places around the world. They're not Americans. In the old days, most of those students tended to stay in the U.S. Today, they have opportunities at home and they go back. And so the result is that we're not kind of getting the full benefit in the U.S. of the virtuosity of those institutions. Let's take an example that occurred recently. General Electric announced a couple of months ago that it is moving its avionics division, its avionics production and technology, into a joint venture with a state-owned Chinese company called AVIC, based in Shanghai. Now, avionics are high-tech. They're not low-tech. Avionics are not labor-intensive. They are technology-intensive, knowledge-intensive, and capital-intensive. Avionics is the kind of thing at which the United States is supposed to excel. Why is GE moving that division and that technology and that production to China? Is it because the production costs will be less in China? And the answer is no. It's not a labor-intensive product. Production costs won't be less in China. Will the product quality be better in China? The answer is no. AVIC has no experience in making avionics. Will the productivity be higher? No, again. So what's going on? And what's going on is that China is going to be a major, it is, and it will be and continue to be, a major market for commercial aircraft. And the Chinese have made it clear to GE and to the other players in the business that if they want to sell in China, they better damn well produce in China. And there's no pushback from the U.S. government. The U.S. government doesn't go to the Chinese and say, listen, you guys want to sell here, you got to produce here. The U.S. government doesn't go to GE and say, whoa, wait a minute, GE. A lot of that technology was developed on the basis of the work you did for the U.S. government. A lot of that technology was based on R&D spending that was partially funded by the U.S. taxpayer. How come you're moving this stuff to China? That discussion doesn't take place. And that's what I say when I say the incentives in the global economy are moving the production of tradable goods and tradable services out of the U.S.
Well, Clyde Prestowitz, I thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Clyde Prestowitz, who's a former counselor to the Secretary of Commerce and the founder and president of the Economic Strategy Institute. He's the author of the best-selling books Trading Places, Asia After the Miracle, Rogue Nation, 3 Billion New Capitalists, The Great Shift of Wealth and Power to the East. And his latest book is The Betrayal of American Prosperity, Free Markets Delusions, America's Decline, and How We Must Compete in the Post-Dollar Era. He also has an article at CNN, Can iPhones and iPads Be Made in the USA? We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Sudan and its leader, a serial killer.
Did it all get real? I guess it's real enough. They got refrigerators full of blood. Another century spent pointing guns at anything that moves. Sometimes I worry that I've lost the plot. My twitching muscles.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Phillips, the director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. Previously, he directed the Conflict Prevention and Peacebuilding Initiative at the American University's Center for Global Peace, taught at New York University's Graduate School of Politics, and worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. He's the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy, and U.S. Intervention, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And when you say, as your article's titled in the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again, it does make one wonder whether or not Sudan's president, General Omar al-Bashir, is something of a kind of serial killer. We've seen so much bloodshed in Sudan. We've had a civil war between the north and the south that went on from 1983 to 2005, and that was settled. But he's since then, He has attacked South Sudan. He's driven out the Dinka, making 100,000 of them homeless. He's attacked civilians in North Kordofan, in the Blue Nile State, and in the Nuba Mountains, killing thousands. I spoke recently with a representative from Amnesty International, Donatella Rivera, who was there witnessing the atrocities in the Nuba Mountains, where under bombing. And it looks like it could actually, the war between the North and South could reignite at any moment. So am I right in assuming that this guy's a serial killer?
He is a serial killer. He's a lot like Slobodan Milosevic. In fact, Richard Holbrook, with whom I used to work at the State Department, said about Milosevic that he would solve a problem by creating a bigger one. That's just what Bashir is doing. He had a serious case of buyer remorse after agreeing to the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005 that set South Sudan on the course towards independence. And his recent spasm of violence has been nothing more than an effort to undermine the new state and to try to reestablish Sudan's control, not only over tribes on its own territory, but oil reserves in South Sudan.
So my understanding is, David Phillips, again, the director of the Program on Peacebuilding and Rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights and the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy and U.S. Intervention, and an article in the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again. So it's not just that Omar Bashir is a serial killer and he's the only head of state indicted by the International Criminal Court. He's also uses, it seems to me that he's a sort of thug hiding behind Islam, and he uses these constant wars as a way to justify his own control of his own people. And he's not particularly popular, from my understanding, but because of essentially martial law conditions, he keeps cracking down on any opposition in the name of being traitors against foreign enemies.
He's been immune from the Arab Spring. Any efforts to organize around the University of Khartoum have been very harshly repressed. The SPLM North, which represents the largest and most coherent opposition movement, has suffered a kind of Kristallnacht where their offices have been ransacked, their leaders arrested. Bashir has systematically undermined his opposition in order to stay in power and preserve what he has left in Sudan.
So how do you deal with this international pariah then? The fact that he's indicted by the International Criminal Court is one thing, but, you know, is he ever going to be extradited? I mean, there isn't a mechanism. It's worth noting, too, that the United States is not a participant in the International Criminal Court as well. So is there any realistic expectation that anything can be done?
And Bashir is deeply entrenched in power, and he's able to travel freely around Africa. Countries in the African Union don't arrest him and send him to The Hague. Sudan is also a member of the Organization of Islamic Conference, and Bashir travels freely to the OIC member states. So until these regional groupings recognize that he's a pariah in their midst, there's really very little pressure that can be brought to bear by Western countries. It also should be mentioned that China continues to run interference for Bashir and Sudan in the Security Council. So particularly after Libya, any kind of robust measures that Western countries want to take that could even remotely suggest a strategy of regime change are vetoed and obstructed by China and by Russia. So there's not a lot of room for diplomatic maneuver. There isn't a security solution. The solution has to come from within Sudan and from countries in the region. There are seven states that border Sudan. This instability has a hugely negative effect, not only in Sudan, but on all of the frontline states. So they have an interest in ratcheting up the pressure on Bashir as well.
But David Phillips, my understanding is that the Saudis have always had close relations, and they're supposedly our friends. What's the role of Saudi Arabia?
They probably have oil interests with the Sudanese state oil corporation. But this isn't really a matter that's going to be addressed by the Gulf states or the Gulf Cooperation Council. This is something that the solution lies with the people of Sudan. And it's important that they organize themselves, that there be an Arab Spring, that we find ways of supporting it, and that the frontline states that have always had their proxies in Sudan's fight, stop meddling in the country's internal affairs, and giving the Sudanese people the room and the space to resolve these problems on their own.
But what can be done to isolate Omar Bashir amongst the African leaders who accept him and the Islamic states who still accept him?
Well, this is the conundrum. If there was an easy solution to that, then the AU and the OIC would be working on it. You're right, Bashir has been very clever by somehow portraying this as a Western cabal or a Western strategy to try to assume ownership of Sudan's oil. There's really been no leadership coming from the AU or the OIC. Even the AU mediator, Thabo Mbeki, seems to be more interested in placating Khartoum than in achieving a durable solution. This agreement between South Sudan and Sudan, you know, it represents progress. You know, it is a step forward, but it has to be implemented, it has to be monitored, and the U.S. and other countries have to find ways of keeping the pressure on so that things don't start to backslide.
But I'm surprised that African leaders and Mbeki would be sympathetic to Bashir, because his whole career is about killing black Africans, Christian black Africans. There's been a racist component to this civil war from the beginning. It's been the Arab and North against the animist and Christian South, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's certainly the case, but there's also an African solidarity in the fight against colonialism, and Bashir has cleverly played on that.
So the fact that he's made a career out of killing black Africans in a racist for racist motivations, and they're still killing people in Darfur, and we've seen what the Janjaweed militia do, and it does seem to be entirely both a combination of race and religion, you'd think that would get some people's attention in Africa.
It should be noted that the AU has taken the lead in deploying a peacekeeping force, that there are thousands of troops from African countries that are on the ground in Darfur. But despite all these efforts and the enormous amount of money that's been spent on humanitarian relief over the years, you've seen over the past 6 months a resumption of violence in Darfur, where the IDP camps are being targeted. There are 500,000 people that have been displaced by violence in eastern Sudan as Bashir has turned his armed forces loose on some of the areas there in North Kordofan and Blue Nile and the Nuba Mountains. So there is leadership coming from the AU. They don't have the capacity to enforce agreements. This Addis Accord from September 27th represents a step forward, but unless you follow it up with diplomacy and you have a really robust and proactive monitoring mechanism that's put in place, you're going to see that agreement start to unravel, and you could very well see a resumption of the kind of civil war between Sudan and South Sudan, in which 2 million people lost their lives.
So would we even know about this but for the efforts of people like George Clooney? I mean, it seems to me that not only are the African leaders somehow not stepping up or compromised, and Mbeki seems to be prone to that kind of thing, then you've got the Islamic leaders basically accepting this guy as one of their own. And as far as I can tell, the only kind of pressure has come from people like George Clooney and other activists in Darfur in particular, pointing out what this guy's up to. But What's your sense about how serious Washington is, or have they come to the same conclusion that, that there's not a lot you can do?
Well, let me comment on the role of activists and the work that George Clooney has done in the past. I brought him and Elie Wiesel give a briefing to the UN Security Council on Darfur some years ago. And I have to tell you, Ian, it was probably the biggest day in the history of the UN. Every staff member, all the member states had people who showed up because they wanted to hear what George Clooney had to say about Darfur. So we shouldn't underestimate the importance of civil advocacy. What the Save Darfur Coalition did, spotlighting the genocide in Darfur, really mobilized all kinds of awareness and international pressure. So, you know, that's very important. How that translates into policy is the challenge that every advocacy organization faces. And the fact of the matter is, the Obama administration, particularly during the run-up to the presidential election, hasn't wanted to create a conflict in Sudan. It already has its hands full with tribalism in Libya and the civil war in Syria. So it's been more than content to work discreetly and behind the scenes to try to support the AU to broker this agreement between Sudan and South Sudan. What we're going to see soon after the election is that unless that agreement is implemented, conditions are going to go bad to worse. And unless you stop a conflict in the early stages, it's going to worsen, and it'll cost more diplomatically and materially to deal with the crisis at the back end.
Well, I have to thank you very much for joining us here today, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the program on peacebuilding and rights at Columbia University's Institute for the Study of Human Rights. Previously, he directed the Conflict Prevention and Peacebuilding Initiative at American University's Center for Global Peace, taught at New York University's Graduate School of Politics, and worked as a senior advisor to the United Nations Secretariat and as a foreign affairs expert and senior advisor to the United States Department of State. He is the author of Liberating Kosovo, Coercive Diplomacy and U.S. Intervention. And he has an article in the Huffington Post, Crisis in Sudan Again. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for streaming and podcasting at ianmasters.com, where we welcome your comments. And the conversation continues online at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.